Okay, so up until now, we've been talking about some very basic aspects of statistics, and now I want to talk a little bit more about some of the technical aspects of statistics. There are two basic uses of statistics that we can divide the field into. The smaller part of it is the very simple use of statistics to summarize and describe a set of data. Of course, even with small data sets that we wouldn't call big data, data sets that are designed to get as much information as possible with as few measurements as possible, so that, for example, with a questionnaire, we're very careful about designing the questions so that the participants in our survey will understand the questions. We do pretests on our surveys, on our questionnaires, in order to make sure that the participants understand the questions the same way that we do, and they give answers that correspond to what we want to know. But even in those cases, we'll be talking about a survey with, oh, several dozen, somewhere between 20 and 50 questions, perhaps. And we typically want to have between 300 and 500 participants if we're doing very simple yes/no kinds of surveys or who will you vote for kinds of surveys, as are done in political polling for elections. And news analysis for elections, we're talking about thousands of observations, thousands of people being talked to. These are small data sets by modern standards, and yet a person can't remember all those numbers, can't grasp all of them. You can read a few surveys and get a sort of feel for what the data is like, but in order to scientifically process this, or at least quantitatively process this, you need to use all the numbers. But people are not designed to deal with all the numbers. There's a famous statistic about people that they can hold 7 ± 2 facts in their mind. If you are thinking about numbers as individual numbers, or in the case of a survey where you're asked how much you like something, whether it's somewhere on the scale between hate and love, and you have like, dislike, and indifferent in between, no matter what the facts are at that level, you can keep only a very few of them in your mind at one time. How do human beings handle more complicated problems? Well, what we do is we divide and conquer. We chunk our data into things that theoretically correspond to each other, and then we take a simple fact about those theories and use that instead of the whole data set. So, for example, the obvious statistic that we use all the time is the mean or average of a bunch of numbers. This use is called descriptive statistics, as you might expect. The second kind of use of statistics is to determine the plausibility of hypotheses, especially scientific hypotheses. This is called inferential statistics. Until recently, inference was the primary focus of statistical theory. Computing various kinds of descriptions is, of course, relatively easy, and the understanding that we have of those requires very simple models. If we have a sample of people and we look at the average height, then what we're thinking is that the average height has some meaning to us. But, for example, when I was first teaching in the University of Tsukuba, we had furniture for the students from the 1960s and 70s still. And people have gotten bigger since then. Also, at the University of Tsukuba, we have started to depend more and more on foreign students who, on average, tend to be a little bit taller than Japanese. And so we had the same kind of effect that you have of a bunch of adults going into a kindergarten to watch the class, and the adults are sitting on chairs designed for five-year-olds, which are much too small. It wasn't quite that bad, but clearly, over time, the university needed to not just upgrade its chairs and desks to new ones, but also make them a little bit bigger to fit the average. On the other hand, even if you have a relatively new set of furniture, the mean is not good enough. When I was teaching at Ohio State, I was teaching in a new classroom in a new building, and they had all new furniture adapted to the students of that time. However, one of my students was a basketball player for the college team. At that time, the college team was ranked in the top 20 in the country, maybe in the top 10. And so they had some very good and very big players. And this particular player, Brad, was 215 centimeters tall. And when he sat down in an ordinary person's chair and kept his feet on the ground, his knees came almost to his shoulders and he looked sort of like a frog. So just the mean doesn't tell us enough. There's more in the data than that. And so we have other numbers that we compute, such as the standard deviation, and that's closely related to something that is used a lot in Japanese education, I think Asian education in general, called hensachi, the number of standard deviations that you are from the mean, plus or minus. Now, it's not the calculation that determines whether a particular use is descriptive or inferential. The calculations are pretty much the same in both cases. There are some differences. For example, when we compute the mean of a sample, trying to guess what the average is for the whole population, we divide by n, the number of people in the sample. If we just wanted to get the average for the whole population, we would divide by m, the number of people in the whole population. So these are basically the same. Sometimes it's a little bit different. In the case of the standard deviation of a population is usually calculated by taking the sum of squared differences from the mean and dividing by n. However, when we have a sample and want to estimate the standard deviation of the population, we divide by n minus 1 for technical reasons. That, in particular, it turns out that the amount of variation measured by dividing by n is a little bit too small. There's a tendency for the mean to move around a little bit in a sample compared to the population in order to account for the variation in the sample relative to the population. So in order to inflate our estimate a little bit to correspond better to an accurate estimate of the standard deviation of the population, we use a different divisor to calculate the average there. But basically, these calculations are very similar, whether we're doing inferential statistics or descriptive statistics. And for example, regression analysis is frequently used to discover cause and effect relationships, or to determine the strength of cause and effect relationships between the so-called dependent variable and the independent or explanatory variables. However, we can also use regression in a very descriptive way and simply say there appears to be a trend in this data. We don't know why there's a trend. We don't know why there's an association between the different variables, but we can measure it and give a coefficient after allowing for other effects and so on. And on the other hand, every statistic that we can compute has a probabilistic theory when we compare it to some theoretical distribution. And so we can use that for inference about that theoretical distribution, whether it seems to be likely to be the case or not. When we are using statistics descriptively, in descriptive statistics, we take the data as given. We don't really worry about why the data is what it is. We can calculate empirical distributions. We can display and smooth them using histograms, either in numerical form or more usually on graphs. We can compute the mean or the median to indicate the approximate location of the data. We can compute the standard deviation or the variance and the range to indicate how spread out or compact the data is. And we can compute a statistic called skewness to indicate the direction and degree of unbalance. These descriptive statistics don't need any probability theory directly. On the other hand, the theory of inferential statistics may help to justify the use of one descriptive statistic rather than another. So, for example, if we have data with many outliers, if it's very likely that there are just a few crazily different individuals in the population, then using the mean, if we have a very, very big value that really never should occur in some sense, then that value is going to go in and as 1 over n, and it's going to affect the mean. In particular, if we have a typical large number, and we take that out and change that to a number twice the size, then that's going to move the mean twice as far. And so that's going to move the mean away from where it was with the smaller number. So if the big tend to get bigger, in some sense, in your data, then using the mean is going to give you a volatile, a changeable estimate of where the data seems to be located, where the data has a central tendency. On the other hand, the median is the 50th percentile. And what that means is that half the data has values bigger and half the data has values smaller. So take our example of the large value and doubling it. This doesn't change the median, right? Because the large value is already larger than 50%, the 50th percentile. And if we double it, it's still larger. So it's on the same side, and we haven't changed the number on either side. So the median stays where it was. So in some sense, the median is more stable than the mean. On the other hand, if we have something where we want to add up some values based on how frequent they are, then the mean gives us a better estimate of what that total will be. Since the mean doesn't, since the median doesn't move, if you double, for example, Jeff Bezos in the American economy, that's going to make a certain amount of difference in the total amount of wealth or the total income in the United States economy. But if you look at the median income, doubling Jeff Bezos and George Soros and Bill Gates isn't going to change the median, and it's not going to help you understand that the gross domestic product increased. On the other hand, if you use the mean, it is sensitive to changes in the extremes. And so it will tell you that the gross domestic product is changing. So depending on how you use it, you may want to use the mean rather than the median, or you may want to use the median rather than the mean. The reason that we can understand this is by thinking about them in probabilistic terms. Now, let's look at inferential statistics. In inferential statistics, or statistical inference, we use statistics to test theories, and we're most interested in Charcot in scientific theories. Inference requires two kinds of models at the same time. One model is what we call the domain model, the model of the science. We put this into a mathematical or logical form so that we can assess it quantitatively, right? Obviously, if we have a nice model in words, we have a good explanation of why people think what they think or something like that, we need to translate that into numbers to use statistics. So if for some reason we think we are going to need a lot of data and we want to summarize that, we're going to need to use statistics. On the other hand, in many kinds of studies that normally we probably wouldn't call scientific, but at least we can think of as systematic, for example, in terms of history or in journalism, where people will interview the people who were directly involved in a decision, for example, then we don't need statistics to understand that study. We can read the comments of the person, we can evaluate the questions of the interviewer, and we can decide whether we believe the conclusions that that interviewer comes to. However, if we're doing, for example, a questionnaire survey, it's not enough to pull out a couple that, having read a few of the surveys, we think are typical, right? Because we're going to lose the outliers. We're going to lose the extreme opinions. We're going to not have a very good sense of the averages or the median of particular questions, unless we actually count them, unless we actually compute statistics. So statistics is not a goal. Statistics is not the reason that we do science. Rather, we do science in a particular way because in order to reason logically and quantitatively about the models and ideas that we're working on, we need to do them quantitatively, and statistics is just the mathematics of the quantitative use of data. It's just the logical way of using quantitative data. So we need a domain model. We need to put the domain model in quantitative or sometimes logical terms in order to make predictions or explanations of the phenomena that we see. And statistics affects this model only because some models are easier to work with in statistics. So, for example, in the old days when we had much slower computers, or when average social scientists had access only to relatively slow computers, or they had to share computers and things like that, we often used linear regression, even though we didn't entirely believe it, because linear regressions are much simpler to calculate, much cheaper to calculate than nonlinear regressions. I had a senpai at Stanford when I was there who was doing what today is a pretty standard kind of nonlinear regression. He wasn't even doing any complicated distributions. He was assuming normal distributions, but the model was nonlinear, and so he had to use a mathematical technique called Newton's method. Newton's method is not as computationally intensive as For example, kernel smoothing or piecewise regression or k-means estimates and things like that that we use in big data these days, but it's much more computationally intensive than linear regression. And he had 187 or 189 parameters in his regression, and basically it took him 6 months to get an answer. And unfortunately for him, the answer was, this estimation is not going to converge to a consistent set of parameters. And so he had to start all over again. Today, that would be unbearable. You'd be willing to wait 3 days for an answer like that. But back then, there was no choice. So statistics, and then there are some statistical models that we don't know how to handle at all yet with our current ability to compute. We may not even have good mathematical solutions for them. So some mathematical models are sort of out of bounds because the statistics would be just too hard to do. But fundamentally, what we want to do is come up with a good scientific model, which is constrained mostly by what data we can collect and not by statistical technology. Then, what is the statistical model? Where do statistics come in here? The statistical model gives the researcher's assumed explanation of why the measurements don't exactly correspond to the domain model. So it might be that the effect itself is somewhat random. So for example, you might have earnings information in the stock market. And you have a particular company, you find out that its earnings are going to be down by 5% in this quarter. And we can come up with a scientific model that says that this information, first of all, tells us that earnings are down, and so the value of the stock goes down by that much for this period. But lower earnings in this period also may indicate lower earnings in future periods. And in that case, our scientific model should inflate the amount of the stock price decrease. It should make it bigger than simply the amount of loss in this period. However, different people will have different mental models of that. Some of them will be in a position to buy and sell the stock, others will not. And so there's a certain amount of randomness in how much the stock price reacts to that. Of course, there are a lot of other issues that go in, but this is a simple example of a very simple explanation of why the model that the finance professor uses does not predict the stock price reaction to an earnings report exactly. If we go on to page 52, we see a number of typical statistical models. So we're going to use a bunch of regression models, and the y variable is always the explained variable, the dependent variable. X is either a single variable or perhaps a vector of variables, and each observation is labeled with t. I use t because I'm thinking about a time series, but t could also be the identifier of the individual in a questionnaire or something like that. So the first kind of model is a measurement error. You simply don't get the right answer. So, for example, in the case of the dependent variable being gross domestic product, there are two ways to measure gross domestic product. One of them is to go into the markets and find out what the quantities of the goods are and what their prices are and how much is being sold and add that up. The other way is to go into the labor and capital markets and see how much money is being paid to the consumers, or rather the workers and the capitalists. And it turns out that these two numbers tend to differ from each other in a systematic way called the statistical discrepancy. The theory says they should be equal if you measure them correctly. But the problem that we have is that exports should be considered gross domestic product because they go out of the economy, they get consumed by somebody else. So exports should be part of GDP, but we don't measure exports very well because in the modern economy, very few governments tax exports the way they do imports. We have good numbers on imports because governments charge tariffs on imports. So every time you bring a good into Japan or into the United States or into China, you have to file a report with the government. Unless it's a very small amount, such as a few cartons of cigarettes or bottles of liquor that you're carrying on an airplane to bring home to your mother or something like that. But if you're a commercial entity and you're bringing in automobiles or rice by the ton or something like that, you have to file a report so that you can pay the government your taxes, customs duties, or tariffs, as they're called. So measurement error occurs, and in particular, something that we'd like to know a lot about in the future, like GDP, measurement error occurs. We don't know how to measure it exactly. And so we have a bunch of variables X that help us to predict what the GDP will be in the future, but GDP is measured with error, and that's the epsilon T at the very end. We have a prediction that should be accurate, but we made some measurement errors, and our YT is the wrong number. And so in order to get an equation between the function of X and Y, we have a difference, which is the error in measurement, epsilon T. We could also have measurement error in the independent variables, the predictors. And in that case, if we leave out measurement error on the dependent variable, we have YT is equal to the sum of alpha K times XK plus epsilon K. And the epsilon K is the amount of measurement error in each individual predictor. Another possible model is that we have variables that are unobserved. So in economics, we have a theory that a person's wage is equal to the value of their marginal product, or the dollar amount that they can produce for their employer. However, we can't measure this wage to find out people's productivity if they're not employed. If they're not getting a wage, then we don't know what they're worth per hour. So the model of unobserved variables says that our marginal productivity, the XT, is going to tell us what the wage is. This predicts our wage. We know that there's some variability here, that there's measurement error. In this case, the measurement error may be on the part of the employer. The employer doesn't recognize the worker's productivity correctly, and they pay him too much or too little, or they estimate his worth at too much or too little. Then the second equation says that if the amount that the employer estimates is high enough, the worker will then take the job, and that is their reservation value, Y upper bar. The Y upper bar says, hey, if you're not going to pay me at least Y upper bar, I'm not willing to work. It's not worth my time. Now that could be, well, basically here we're assuming that the person is unemployed because we don't see their productivity at all. So if they're employed, then they get paid Y hat and their actual wage is equal to Y hat. But otherwise, we don't know what it is. And so we have this data set that says either you're out of the labor force, in which case we have to estimate your productivity as somehow less than Y bar, or you're in the labor force and we can estimate your productivity more accurately by using your wage as an estimate. An even more complicated model than any of the above is the so-called REM coefficients model. And that is the case when you can measure your variables, but the effect of the variable is uncertain from one observation to the next. So for example, if you have a set of employee characteristics that you can measure, such as their knowledge of foreign languages, their knowledge of math and statistics, their ability to speak in countries with strict immigration rules, you might care about their visa status, and all of these things affect their productivity, but each employer has a different measure of that. That would be a random coefficients model, because each employer is going to weight those various characteristics differently. And we can only estimate the average by looking at the workers. We'd have to actually somehow measure the value to the employers, but this may be very subjective on the part of the employers, so it's very difficult to measure. And so typically in this kind of model, we look at the workers whose characteristics are generally fairly easy to measure. How many years of education, how old they are, how much experience they have in the job that they're doing or being asked to do. In cases where we're looking for discrimination effects, we might ask about gender or race, things like that. And each employer is going to have their own private values for each of these characteristics, and so we have a random coefficients model. Okay, so in each of these cases, we think about how the evaluation of some variable is going to affect the evaluation of other variables. In the case of measurement error on the dependent variable, we have some reason to believe that we can't measure it accurately, and we just add some so-called noise to it. There's an error, we don't know what it is, we assume that it's unbiased, plus or minus around zero. Other variables, the regressors, could also be dependent, have measurement error. This differs from the other by the fact that the errors get multiplied by the coefficients, and so that makes the behavior of the total amount of error in the prediction, the difference between yt and the sum of alpha k times xk, variable according to what we estimate the alphas to be. In the case of the unobserved variable, we have a theory of productivity, but we can't observe productivity directly. We can only observe it through the wage when a person is employed. And so we would like to use the information about the characteristics of people who are unemployed. Do they have lower education than people who are employed? There's usually an assumption that high education leads to high wages, and other things being equal, you would expect those people to be more likely to accept jobs. So if we're trying to measure productivity through wages, you would expect that you would find a lot more low education people in the unemployed. And we would like to test that hypothesis with the data. In order to do that, we need a model that understands that some people have measurements of productivity and others don't.